Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, it's episode 26 of the Potential Psychology Podcast. Welcome, everyone. It's Ellen Jackson here. I am your host. And before I tell you a little bit about what I've learned this week and also introduce our fabulous guest, I would like to say thank you to Naomi, who emailed me this week. Actually, she sent me a message via LinkedIn to say that she has been enjoying the podcast. She has been listening while she's been training for a marathon, which is just beyond my comprehension personally. But she has been listening. She said that she's found the episodes that we've done recently on sports and performance have been particularly helpful as she's run uphill and down Dale in her many, many hours of preparation. So thank you to Naomi, and I hope the race went well. I hope you achieved your goals. And that leads me into what I'd like to talk about just briefly. And that is a theme that I noticed this week. And the theme for me, I don't know if you notice themes in things like I do, but I noticed themes. And the theme for me this week was that as a psychological concept called self-efficacy. Now, self-efficacy is essentially our belief in our ability to succeed, usually in a specific domain or a specific area. So I might have great self-efficacy around my ability to whip up dinner quickly when required, or I might have great self-efficacy in my ability to present in front of a group, something that I do a lot of, but it's domain specific. It doesn't necessarily mean that I have a belief in my ability to do everything. I certainly don't have great self-efficacy when it comes to running a marathon like Naomi has. But it has been a theme that's come. It came up first as I was being interviewed by Jamin Fraser, who has a podcast called The Insecurity Project. And I was on the receiving end. I was his guest on the podcast, which was wonderful. And we had a fabulous conversation. And I'll let you know when that's out on the airwaves. And we were talking about the notion of insecurity and the fact that in psychology, insecurity isn't so much a concept, certainly not in the sense of not feeling that you have a strong belief in yourself or having a kind of a negative appraisal of yourself or feeling insecure about who you are in the world, and how that isn't really a particular concept in psychology. We talk about self-esteem and self-concept and self-belief. And one of the components of that is this notion of self-efficacy, this belief in our ability to achieve our goals or to meet our challenges in a specific area of our life. So that was the first time it came up. Then it came up again a day or so later when I was at a professional development seminar looking at leadership coaching, and our presenter, Peter Zaris, who's an organizational psychologist, was talking about leaders and their capabilities in different areas and how some, like everyone, because leaders in organizations are just humans too, will have high self-efficacy in some areas and perform really well, but may not perform as well in other areas of their role, perhaps pertaining to the people side of things or pertaining to results orientation, whatever it might be. And often that is because underlying that is this lack of self-efficacy, this lack of belief in their ability to achieve their goals or do what they need to do in that particular domain. And then it came up for me personally because I hit publish on ticket sales for my first ever public workshop. It's called Managing Your Mind and Your Day for Better Productivity, and it's pitched at solopreneurs, self-employed people like myself and small business here in my hometown of Ballarat. And it is my first ever public workshop, and that's really terrifying because whilst I have self-efficacy in relation to my ability to present the content, I know I can do that. I'm comfortable with that. Putting yourself out there and saying to people, come and see me, that is an area where I don't have particular self-efficacy. That feels really, really uncomfortable. So I was very proud of myself for hitting go and putting that out there in the world. If you're in Ballarat and you'd like to attend, I'd love to see you there. But it feels uncomfortable just because of that low self-efficacy. And beautifully, it's come up in today's podcast episode as well. So let me introduce you to today's guest. We're turning our attention to kids, students, and young people for the next couple of episodes of the podcast. And today we're talking about helping our kids and young people to find a sense of hope and purpose. And I'm thrilled to introduce my guest, Rachel Koller. Rachel is the director of Merakai, an educational consultancy that helps schools and organizations lead the way in well-being and performance. She's a psychologist, consultant, speaker, facilitator, and mum. She's also a member of the teaching team at the Centre for Positive Psychology at the University of Melbourne at both the undergraduate and postgraduate levels. And she's passionate about helping us all to achieve optimal well-being and happiness in our lives in order to be better parents, friends, colleagues, and members of our community. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks so much, Ellen. Delighted to be here.
I'm very glad. We were just discussing the fact that it has taken us a bit of toing and froing to get to this point, but it's lovely to welcome you on board as a guest to the podcast.
Thank you.
And I've got lots and lots of questions for you, Rachel, but I'm going to start by asking you a bit about hope, because hope is kind of central to the work that you're doing, and I'll get you to explain a little more about what that is shortly. But hope, from a psychological point of view, is more than just having a kind of optimistic idea for the future, isn't it?
Absolutely. And Ellen, I often say that, you know, hope is not that Pollyannaism, you know, fingers crossed, I'm hoping that it's all going to be okay. From a psychological perspective, it's far more powerful than that. And, you know, I think Rick Snyder probably explained it best when he said that we need to think about hope as being really, it's a dynamic motivation system. And so it's much more than that belief that things are going to work out. There's kind of two key components to it from a psychological perspective. So one of those is a sense that when we're moving towards our goals, we have a real strong sense of energy around that. And that's what he refers to as, you know, our agentic thinking, if you like. So we believe that we've got the willpower to be able to push through towards our goals and to be able to overcome obstacles. And that's probably a well understood part of hope. But I think a less understood part is what he refers to as way power. And that is our capacity to think through a whole variety of different pathways through which we can actually move towards our goals. And that for me, I think, is a real key. It's not just that sense of, do I have a sense of willpower, but actually, do I have the means and the capacity to think through what are the different ways through which I can achieve that goal? So it's that double combo of way power plus willpower.
So far more complex than just wishful thinking or optimism.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a lot of research that really differentiates between optimism and hope. But it is indeed far more complex. And one of the things that I love about, you know, Snyder's model is I often refer to it as this beautiful, elegant simplicity. You know, it talks just about those two components of being way power and willpower. But actually, when we dive into the depth of what underpins that, there's some really amazing stuff that can enable us to get some fantastic outcomes. And that's really where my research is now diving into, is moving beyond just that sense of way power and willpower, but actually looking at another couple of powers that are really seeming to be key to this, which is a sense of why power or purpose, as well as a sense of who power. So being able to tap into that really important relational component. We know that we're not little individuals in silos, that we all exist within really important social systems.
Okay, so before, because I'll drill down on some of that stuff in a moment, but before we do that, you know, for our listeners, why is hope important?
Hope is critical, I think, and hope is particularly critical in today's environment. So one of the things that we know about hope is it really allows us to unlock our potential. And one of the ways that it does that is it enables us to tap into the things that are really important to us, but it also fuels our persistence. And that's really key to being able to move, as we say, beyond kind of that wishful optimism to really be able to move towards outcomes. And interestingly, Ellen, there's been amazing research that's actually just come out in the last, it's less than 12 months old now, that has really looked at the role of a whole variety of different traits and principles and ways of thinking that can help us become more resilient, and particularly more resilient in the face of uncertainty. And I'm sure, as many of your listeners are aware, that certainly encapsulates the world that we're living in right now.
And yeah.
Particularly for our young people, a real sense of uncertainty. And when you dive into that research, it turns out that hope is actually the only one of seven traits, including things like grit, that actually predict our resilience in the face of that uncertainty. And so for me, when I look at, you know, what our organizations are dealing with, what our young people are dealing with in terms of what the future is looking like, that makes hope really critical.
Yeah, well, that's what I was about to ask you. You've just explained it for me. But, you know, what is the role particularly for young people? Because that's part of a focus of our conversation today is, you know, if there's a strong connection between, is it a capacity for hope? Is it a...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's really interesting. So, you know, and this is, I suppose, more from a research perspective, Alan, so not always as relevant to all listeners in the audience, but some people consider hope to be, I guess, that latent capability that we can ignite. But some of the work that I'm now doing and drawing upon in a variety of different scholars is that it's really an incredible resource. And so it's a resource that we all possess, and it's about developing up that capability to look at how do we best ignite that in our young people. And some of the reasons I think that's so important is, you know, from an education perspective, hope has got significant impact on educational outcomes. So we know that for our schools, this is a really key part of their core business, right? So not only do they want their young people to have that really important sense of well-being, but they're also looking to be able to make sure that all students can achieve their potential within their education realm. And hope has really been shown to be a key mechanism in supporting that.
Okay. So there's a lot of compelling arguments here. We've got it's important in well-being, it's important in fulfilling our potential, it's important in educational outcomes, it's important in our resilience. So it's clearly...
It's not a bad concept, right?
It's got lots of stuff going on for it. But what, so what does a young person who has hope look like?
Great question. So some of the markers that we see in people that are high in hope, and certainly more when we're talking about our young people, is that they are much more likely to set learning goals. So their goals are not just about achieving performance outcomes, but they're really good at being able to stretch themselves and say, where else could I go? What else could I actually develop in? We also know that they're really good at what we call more positive problem orientation. So not only can they kind of critique and look at where are the gaps and what do I need to do, they're really good at broadening out their perspective and saying, well, what else could I draw on to be able to resolve this particular issue?
Okay.
One of my favorites, I have to say, there was a mother of four daughters. One of the key characteristics of high hope young people is they actually set goals based on their own standards, not those of others. And yeah, obviously as a mother of daughters, that's really critical for me.
Okay. So that's being able to, I suppose, there's all sorts of kind of concepts that are popping into my head as we talk about that. So, you know, even just the idea of self-awareness, I suppose, and having awareness of who we are, and therefore, what is it we're aiming for in life? What's important to us? What does give us a sense of purpose? What are our goals? Yeah. That sounds like it's a component for it. And as you say, for young people who, I suppose the nature, I mean, I'm not an expert in parenting and well, other than kind of doing it myself.
makes you categorically an expert. I always say case study N of one is really important.
It works. But teens are susceptible to external, I mean, we're all susceptible to external pressures, but teens and young people and young adults are perhaps because of that developmental phase they're going through are going to be looking to others, external forces, social pressures, friends to kind of guide them and, you know, who they should be and what they should do.
Yes.
So this hope concept, does it need to be more internal? Where does the learning and development of this come in?
That's such a great question. And I suppose that's where I think parents play such a pivotal role, because what the research is really telling us is that development happens right throughout our lifespan. So the ways in which we interact with all those important people, be they parents, obviously in that early formation phase, teachers are really key to doing that in a school environment, but also peers, all of that plays a role in how we actually develop hope. And it comes from some of those feedback loops, which is why I say that, you know, who power is really important, the people that we have around us and, you know, the feedback and information they're giving us around our efforts are a key part to how we internalize that sense of hope and can then draw on that as a resource.
Okay. So from a practical point of view, if you've got a young person who is getting these messages, there's some messages that are helpful, some that perhaps are not so helpful. Can you give us an example of what a helpful kind of message, what's helpful input into that feedback loop that's going to help develop somebody's sense of hope?
Yeah. I think one of the really great helpful loops is being able to give the young person feedback on what you're seeing in terms of their progress. And so rather than focusing on outcomes, it's very much about picking up on the strategies that they're utilizing and reinforcing and building up the strengths that we're seeing in them helps them to internalize, actually, I've got these resources myself that I can draw upon and they're being reflected back to me that they're actually really useful. So we kind of take away the focus from end goal outcome, which can take a long time to achieve, to instead focusing on what they're doing as they move towards that.
So I have two boys who are age 10 and 7. Yeah. And one of the things that I try to do with them is instill a sense of problem solving, you know, a bit of efficacy around problem solving, you know.
Yeah.
They come to me with an issue. I can't find this. I lost that. Well, what could you do about it?
Yeah.
Rather than here it is. Or I mean, I must admit there's a fair bit of here it is. I live in a house full of men. So, but.
And time factors.
Yeah, that's true, too. But I mean, is that an example of that sort of feedback loop of saying, what could you do about it? And then I'm really proud of you for solving that problem yourself or figuring it out yourself or at least trying to figure it out. Yes,
absolutely, Alan. And so you're tapping into the second part of hope, which is really critical. So when we're talking about the first part, we're talking up building up our young people's sense of agency and that they actually, you know, have that capacity to impact on their world. And the second part is that pathways thinking, right? So it's about helping them to be able to look at, well, how else might I be able to solve this? So I often do the same with my own kids. You know, I think about my youngest. She's like, just give me the answer, Mom. I just want the answer.
Must be so annoying being the child of a psychologist.
I know. And they tell me that all the time. Could you just be a mum now, Mum? I'm like, yes, but I can't unlearn what I know, sweetie.
Especially when you know it's the important stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's it. I think it's about, you know, challenging ourselves to and modeling that, you know, how often do we just go for the same old pathway, but actually saying, you know, and reflecting to our kids, hey, you know what? I tried this and it didn't work. And so now I'm going to have to challenge myself to come up with, you know, some other ways to do that. Do you have any ideas, you know, drawing them into even some of our own problem solving?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one. And that's kind of thing. I actually encourage that in working with leaders in workplaces. So trying to, and I think we can do it as parents as well. You know, I always say in workplaces, just, you know, take your manager hat off. You know, we turn up to work and we think we've got this hat that we've got to wear that says I should be able to solve every problem, know every answer, do everything. But, you know, take that off, be genuine in your, you know, I tried and it didn't work. You know, we're going to try this instead. Show that you're kind of vulnerable and human. And I guess, in modeling that, I can understand that that would make sense from a parental point of view, having those conversations with your kids and saying, yeah, look, you know, I thought this was a really good idea, but it's just not. We tried and it didn't work. Let's try something else.
Absolutely. And I think that that authenticity piece is so important for any leader. And you know what? Parents are leaders as much as leaders in organizations are. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think for myself, when I'm leading in an organization, I think I've learnt well over time to become much more of a facilitator rather than a fixer. And that's often the language that I'll use in organizations that, you know, your job is not to fix everything for your staff. Your job is actually to create that curiosity and find processes to facilitate how they can build up that capability. And you know what? The same's true as a parent, right? Like, my job is not to fix everything for my kids. My job is to facilitate building them up to have that capability themselves.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I see the outcomes of that when it comes to my sports coaching. I've been lucky enough just to be up at the Victorian Junior State Titles for netball over the weekend and, you know, building up a sense of capability and functionality for our athletes where the parents can't fix it for them. They're the only ones that are out there on court. That's critical to their success.
Yeah, and they are. This is growth and development and opportunity for, and I can see where that taps into that resilience piece as well, that kind of knowing that I've tried something, it didn't work, but I know I can try something else. I can use my own resources, my brain, my experience to be able to come up with an alternative pathway and test that and see if that works.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a little bit about that way power or, you know, pathways. How do we get to where it is we need to go? I'm intrigued about the agency side of it, that willpower, because I have perhaps a loose grasp of Rick Snyder's work and this piece, but I'm really interested, especially for our listeners who might be parents or coaches or teachers, to unpick what that looks like for kids and how we help them to develop that piece.
And that's really interesting, Ellen, because that is actually, it's the agency piece that I think has really taken me to say, I think there's actually more to hope than just those two components. Okay. Because when we dive into how we actually build up that sense of agency, that's where I think there's much more coming out in terms of that. So agency is a sense of I can, if you like, that I've been able to see that what I do in the world has an influence, has an impact. And as a result, it creates that sense of energy that means that I'll keep pushing forward. And there's a variety of ways that that develops. You know, some of that is through learning delayed gratification. Some of that is through, you know, building up our sense of regulating our emotions, that when I'm feeling really stressed, I might just need a bit of a to, you know, refuel and then be able to come back. So there's a variety of really practical strategies that allows us to build that up over time. But one of the things that I've really started delving into is a key resource that's missing in that is a sense of purpose, because we know that when our goals are aligned to a sense of purpose, that actually creates a real fuel and energy in us to continue pushing through many of the obstacles.
It's the why, isn't it?
It's the why, absolutely. And that's why I've really started saying in my, you know, expanded model of hope theory, why power is critical. It's not just, yeah, it's important to have goals that are of value, but that in and of itself creates a real resource. And so if we bring that back to our young people from a developmental perspective, that's what they're going through. You know, our young teenagers are going through, you know, what on earth am I here for? What? Why do I matter? What is most important? And they're seeking that input from their environment, whether that's peers or teachers or sport or, you know, some even their part-time work and volunteering that they're doing. That's where they're getting those feedback into what they enjoy, what lights them up. And that's some of the work that we're really trying to delve into more in the work that I'm doing.
Okay, so that lights you up piece, you know, that kind of why. I know, you know, we talk about this being perhaps difficult to attain for young people, but I know that it's also difficult to attain for quite a lot of, you know, adults as well. It's not something we're taught to do.
No, it certainly
hasn't been. Maybe that's changing now. Maybe your work is going to kind of lead the pathway down to actually having these conversations with kids. Hopefully it is, because I know that can feel absent and therefore make things like goals and decision making about career or study path or where to live or what to do, or all sorts of the decisions that we make as adults. If we don't really have a strong sense of that purpose, where am I going and why, we're flying blind a little bit, aren't we?
Absolutely. And it's often, you know, I often say it's like being rudderless. You know, we don't kind of have that keel or anchor that keeps us on track. And, you know, if I think about, you know, the environment that we're talking about now, you know, what are the current statistics about how many roles our young people will have by the time they're, I think the last stat that I looked at was 14 different jobs before they're, you know, 35. And that's the reality, is that, you know, it's going to be a really complex environment that we're now trying to prepare our young people for. And part of what I've been doing in the work that I've been working with young people is saying, and you know what, if you're clear on what your overarching purpose is, you can then use that to define what is right in that, because it may look very squiggly in terms of the pathway to get to your goals, but if those things then align to what is most important to you, you're going to continue to get the benefits from all we know about that strong sense of well-being, that strong sense of meaning that can actually fuel us.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the question that I'm sure is in everybody's minds as we listen to this. How do we develop a sense of purpose? How do we discover what our purpose is?
Well, I actually like to say that we've got to get out of this sense that we've got to find our purpose, that somewhere it's out there and it's missing, and if I can just find it.
Hunt it down.
If we just hunt it down. And, you know, for our listeners, I don't know if you're like me, I keep saying the blonder I get and the older I get, and whether the blonde's grey or not, who knows? The more I'm sure that my capacity to find things is diminishing. But I often use the analogy of trying to find your keys. So if we think that our keys are lost, you know, think through what the processes we go through. It kind of heightens our sense of anxiety. Oh my gosh, I've got to get out the door. I can't find. We'll retrace our steps. I don't know about you, but I go to the fridge. Like, look in the most random of places that
I just look at my handbag over and over again, like they're going to mysteriously appear at some moment, even though they didn't all the other times I looked.
Exactly. And they're the sorts of behaviours that we engage in when we think something is lost. And Laura King, I think, really said this beautifully a number of years ago. She said, we need to understand that everyone is born with purpose. Every single one of us, you know, has that sense that we matter. Our job is to be able to clear away some of the fog that you can just allow that to rise to the surface. And so it's not about, you know, going on this great searching mission, but rather I like to say it's a process of curiosity. Let's actually start to tune into what are we noticing in the environment, and what clues is that giving us to the things that we can actually bring to life. So there's a couple of things that I think are really important in terms of building up purpose. And to your point earlier around that's a really key issue for a number of people, we're seeing significant anxiety in our young people about where to next. Like, if I don't know what I want to do with my life and I'm in year nine and I'm already being channeled down into having to decide on my, you know, year 12 subjects, that creates that sense of anxiety. And that's part of what we need to be able to let go of and allow our young people to start discovering what are the things that are important to them. And so much of the research has shown us that instead of turning all of our intention or our attention rather inwards, that it's much more powerful to turn our attention outwards, that often we find our sense of purpose through contributing to other people and seeing the impact that it can actually have. And so a lot of the work that I'm now doing with young people is helping them to be experimenters, you know, try things on, try applying, you know, some of your strengths and talents into different areas where you're curious and you're interested, and then analyze it, you know, kind of see how does that fit? Does it actually light you up or doesn't it?
Yeah, that's wonderful. So it is a process. I talk a lot about with my clients, the process of testing and learning.
Yeah.
Trying something and then paying attention. Did it work? Didn't, you know, this goes back to the stuff that I did in my master's at Sydney Uni in coaching psych.
Yeah, absolutely.
That model of, you know, did it work? If so, do more of it. If it didn't, then let's have a look around and see what else we can try.
Absolutely.
And see if that works for us. So,
yeah.
So I love that concept. Just coming back to the point you made about purpose and the fact that, or this idea that rather than it being something we have to hunt for, it's something that's already within us. Mm. And through a process of perhaps paying attention and, again, maybe that self-awareness, so doing a bit of exploration through practical stuff, you know, it doesn't, I think often when we think about self-awareness, we think about, you know, kind of the navel-gazing type.
In your head, yeah.
Yeah, I've just got to sit there and think, which clearly, you know, if anxiety is playing a part in this, is not going to help. It just makes it worse.
Yeah.
So using a practical approach to self-awareness, a practical using, you know, just experience, trying things, paying attention to how we feel in response to it. I'm interested too in the notion of others' observations of us. That's certainly something I use in a coaching context.
Yeah.
You know, when someone's talking to them, I reflect back what I'm seeing in terms of their facial expression and their body language.
Okay.
You know, are they looking kind of, they say, oh yeah, I'm going to take on this particular role. And at the same time, their shoulders kind of slump and they just look miserable, versus when you see their eyes light up and just the passion kind of spill forth from them.
Absolutely.
And that as an indicator of, you know, that's where you should be. That's the stuff.
Absolutely. And often we need that distance, right? We're not able to do that ourselves. And so you're absolutely right. And, you know, Alan, the work that I've been doing in the Hope Labs program, I've actually based it on a coaching model. So it is actually about, you know, using those reflective others to be able to support us in seeking that out. And one of the other things that I think is really important is, you know, to remind kids that it's about playing. And so really try to bring that sense of play and experimentation, that we're at our most creative and generative when we're really young in many ways. And it's about how we continue to harness that and protect that, as opposed to losing that the more that we age.
Mm. This is an interesting one from a parental perspective. Looking at, because I mean, I'm passionate about helping people to find their strengths, uncover their strengths, you know, all of this stuff that we're talking about, and, you know, what lights you up and doing more of it, because we know that doing more of that contributes to our well-being, as well as giving us a sense of, you know, who I am, what I'm good at, what I enjoy, perhaps where that might lead us.
Mm.
But I've got two kids, and one is very sporty.
Mm.
And loves his sport. And we know that that is a thing for him. You know, it's, he loves it. It's, he will put it over and above everything else. It's an easy path.
Yeah.
And the other one is far more creative, but at the moment, a lot of that is manifesting in Minecraft. And you know, I can kind of rationalize that in my own, you know, it's about the tension, I suppose, for parents of, you know, understanding that, you know, this is something that's really key for him. And I know, as a psychologist, or at least I think I know, that it is something about the creative process that he engages in doing this that is lighting him up, because I can see parallels with, he loves his Lego, he loves to draw, he loves to create little books, you know, all of those sorts of things. So looking for those themes. But I know that I can do that in part because I've spent the last 20 years studying that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What are your tips perhaps for parents who are looking at their kids who want to help them develop this sense of purpose, you know, in terms of, you know, what should they look for? How do they help them and guide them?
Yeah, so I think, again, we can draw on a lot of coaching when it comes to parenting, that, you know, if we can actually continue to reflect back to our kids, hey, I'm seeing you do this, so, you know, or tell me what's exciting about this. Help me to understand, what is it about Minecraft that you like? I know when I talk to my daughters who play Minecraft across the room with one another.
With each other.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they'll often say, yeah, it's creating, but it's actually the collaboration. I mean, that I use those words, but, you know, it's actually connecting and playing together that really is what's exciting them. And so I think as parents, one of the tips for us is to continue to be curious and kind of suspend that judgment, because I go, screen time, you know, like, and all of my anxiety comes up, as opposed to actually delving in with my kids. Well, what is it about this activity that you are really getting something out of? And, you know, then being able to reflect back, well, hey, here maybe are some of my concerns about that. How might we be able to come over this together? So I think that's really important. The other thing that I was going to say with that, though, I think is one of the things that we can do as parents is, and it's probably easier perhaps as our kids are younger, is to help them kind of reflect back what their strengths are and maybe even start mapping where they can play with that in other areas. So this is a real strength that I see in you. How might we be able to use that in a whole variety of different areas? You know, so how might you use your creativity to perhaps help other people? And that, as I said, that then turns that focus outwards rather than always being this inner focus, which can actually shut us off from some of those real resources that we have in our circles.
Yeah. Okay. So paying attention perhaps to what we see in our kids and what excites them and engages them.
Mm.
Using what we know as coaching, which is really just a process of asking questions, isn't it? Absolutely. That curiosity and asking questions, you know, what is it? Why do you, you know, what do you get out of it? And kids won't, especially as they're younger, perhaps might not have the words for that. But if we observe it in parallel, maybe we can start to see, you know, what, and see linkages. I think that's the thing that's always helped me, is to see linkages between, you know, a bit like I was saying with my youngest, there's the Lego, loves building things out of Lego, also loves to draw and write, also loves the Minecraft. And the linkage there for me is, you know, he likes to create stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And we as parents can do that, right? We have the capacity to be able to stand back and actually see the patterns. And I think, again, this is where we can be a really vital piece of the puzzle in terms of saying, hey, I've actually seen you do this really well as X, Y, and Z. So we're actually, you know, giving that feedback to our young people around some of the patterns that we might be observing.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. I feel better about what I'm doing now. I'm creating nice purpose and instilling hope. So you mentioned the Hope Labs program, which is a program that you've developed. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, sure. I'd be delighted to. I guess this program came out of a real gap that I was seeing in terms of our approach to being able to build hope. So, you know, there's been an amazing number of schools that have implemented and applied some really core positive psychology principles in the way in which they are teaching and the way in which they're actually explicitly building up the well-being of our young people. But when I started diving into what was available, it was really interesting that next to no one is actually tapping into hope as part of that. It's kind of this implicit conceptual piece, but it's not something that we're necessarily explicitly looking at how we can build. And I guess part of that came out of my actual master's program research, which was looking at what are some of the more sustainable ways that we can build these practices into schools so it doesn't just become another program. I think that I don't know if there's any teachers on the line, you'll be like me, we're so tired of programs. And there is just such demands on the curriculum already that I really wanted to be able to create an experience, if you like, or an approach that schools would then be able to take and apply in whatever way they wanted to. And so really it's a toolkit, if you like, of different approaches that schools can take on to build that into their ongoing pedagogy and build up their practices to enhance hope for their young people. So the way in which it's designed as it stands right now, and this is in its first iteration, so I'm always very open to the fact that, you know, it's a bit like design thinking. I teach design thinking in the program, and so I always see this to be, you know, the first prototype iteration that I'm sure will evolve over time. But the way it works is that it actually draws on the best of what we know about the neuroscience of learning. So you actually touched on this earlier, Ellen, when you were saying, you know, it's not about us telling our kids, but rather about providing opportunities for them to experience things. And that is a key way through which we build skills. So we know from neuroscience that there are probably four key areas that are really important well-being skills that actually enhance our capacity to learn. And they're the four foundations that the program is built on. So we're talking about awareness, and that's that, you know, self-reflection, our capacity to be able to say, oh, what's going on here? Or even to be able to hone our attention, which is a really important, you know, that's kind of a first step to be able to do. It's also about being able to develop connection. And so how we can create that sense of empathy, because if we're to be able to develop different pathways towards our goals, we've got to have a sense of empathy of what's going to enable us to get there. But it's not about teaching, oh, empathy is important. It's actually about providing opportunities for them to experience that. And then the final two pieces of that, you know, neuroscience puzzle are developing a sense of insight. And this is really important, again, for us to develop that self-awareness of where am I feeling things? So when I talk about being lit up, what does that actually feel like? You know, do I get sweaty palms? You know, do I start feeling like my, you know, blood's racing? And giving a variety of tools and strategies, as you said earlier, to give kids language around that, because that's tricky. We don't often have the language around that. And then finally, and from my perspective, the most important piece is helping them develop a sense of purpose. And we know from a learning perspective that if we can link learning back to the meaning and the purpose of that, it actually enhances outcomes for our young people. So that's kind of the foundation on the approach, if you like, or the how. But the what is around really building up a whole process of skills that we know come from, you know, great exemplars such as organizations that have taken on design thinking. We do a lot of innovation planning. So we're actually drawing on many of the tools that I've actually worked with organizations in terms of taking them through a process to be able to refine their goal setting and building that out. Would it be helpful to tap in, or kind of just direct leaders to some of the other aspects? What would be helpful for your audience, Ellen?
Well, I'm just thinking about, you know, from a teacher's perspective, because I know, I mean, even when you introduce that idea, it is, and I think back perhaps to when I was at school, and I know teaching has certainly changed a lot since then, but this idea that rather than telling someone what it's all about, you know, giving them the opportunity to experience it, and then all of those processes that you talked about in terms of self-reflection and awareness and that mindfulness around how it makes you feel. Yeah. And it is a new way, or a newer way of thinking, and engaging people. Have you got any kind of practical examples of where somebody's used this, perhaps in a classroom, and what the outcome's been?
Yeah. One of the ways this has been applied is a school that I was working with actually had them develop innovation programs. So they used the innovation model and actually matched that to how the students could address one of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. So kind of use that as a framework. And what they did was actually look at, well, first of all, let's map out, and this is part of the toolkit of the Hope Labs program, let's actually have our kids go through a process of mapping out what their strengths are. So they actually go through that discovery process.
Yep. Wonderful.
Not just personally, but tapping into what others actually see as part of their strengths. So if you think about it in a workplace perspective, it's almost like 360-degree feedback.
Yeah.
But in a really safe and secure kind of environment, if you like, to gather that. Looking also at what their talents are or their skills are, but then importantly looking at how they can map that to their interest areas. So using those SDG goals as a way of saying, well, what interests me? Like, what am I curious about? Am I curious about sustainability, and how might I be able to use my strengths and talents in the service of that particular goal? So they've then gone through the innovation model, which is actually Jason Clark's fantastic innovation model, to then build out that project. And they've followed on with subsequent lessons in design thinking, where they actually then take that project idea through an iterative process to really build out a core concept that gives them the experience of empathy and pathway thinking and creativity and divergent thinking and all of these core underlying processes that we know actually build up a sense of hope. But they're doing it in an experiential way, as opposed to teaching them pathway thinking is important.
Yeah, and that's what I was just sort of thinking as you were describing, especially that second. There were two points, I suppose, that really came to mind when you were talking about that. The first was the even giving kids the opportunity or the understanding around individual difference. Mm. The fact that, you know, I might be really interested in the, if we're thinking about a project around something like the United Nations, for example, I might be really interested in the population facts and figures for, you know, a task or whatever it is, or a country or, you know, the countries that we're looking at, but somebody else might be really interested in the culture of those countries, and somebody else might be really interested in the geography. You know, I'm trying to think at my, you know, 10-year-old's level, so maybe a grade four type project. Yeah. And the fact that we are different and we're drawn to different things, and the fact then that when we're doing the bit that interests us and plays on those strengths, it's easier to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And not only is it easier to do, it's actually intrinsically motivating. And so, you know, it's kind of that upward spiral. We enjoy doing it. We're good at doing it. We want to do more of it. So we become better at doing it.
Yeah.
And that's one of those relationships that leads to students high in hope having better academic outcomes, because they're working on things that they're intrinsically interested in. And I think schools have done a really good job of starting to build this in with project-based learning. This is really just providing them with a framework and the tools to be able to apply that with the underlying science behind it.
Yeah, and that was the second part of what you were describing that kind of struck me, was that it's not teaching. We don't need to teach them even the concepts. The kids don't necessarily need to understand that this is pathway thinking and this is, you know, hope theory or any of those. And, and, you know, maybe even to some extent the teachers don't need to know that. I mean, it's always good if they know why they, you know, whatever they're doing works, but not so much getting into the nitty gritty of that, but actually having the kids experience it.
Yeah.
And that is what is building that growth and that sense of purpose without them necessarily having to understand the ins and outs of why.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about our young people, they're all at varying stages in terms of their capability for that sort of literacy, right? But every one of them has the capacity to experience and build up that learning. And that's why I think it's a more powerful model of really being able to quickly and more sustainably build a sense of hope, as opposed to that more conceptual, you know, declarative learning processes that we go through.
Yeah, because we've all got the capacity to pay attention to what feels good or what feels right or what feels interesting, and that's playing a part in it.
Absolutely.
Okay, fascinating. So interesting. So I'm interested to know a bit more about you. What led you to this particular area? Because you didn't start out here, did you?
No, I certainly didn't start out here. Although interesting, I often joke that my career has, you know, probably been that, you know, iterative circular, and I've kind of almost...
They all?
Absolutely. That's what I tell kids all the time. Hi, this is normal. It's not a straight line from A to B. And, you know, I think that's a really important thing that we need to be building for our young people, that it's not a straight line from A to B. In one of the schools that I ran this with recently, we actually had a guest speaker night, and four amazing panelists, you know, head of director of people and culture of large, large corporations, you know, CEO of AFL organizations, amazing, amazing people. And of that panel of four, two out of the four actually failed VCE, or what was VCE HSC in the time. And yeah, for our young people to actually hear the iterations of where they got to as part of their story was really key, I think. And that was one of the big things that came back.
That must be a big part of hope, to know that, I mean, that's part of the other pathway thinking, isn't it? That,
yeah, you
know, it's not necessarily a direct straight line. And just because you struggle perhaps at school, or things happen, you know, sometimes things happen, and yeah, there's accidents and there's illnesses and things that preclude you from following the path you thought you were going to take, to have hope that there are other ways to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that in effect is my story. And so you just captured it beautifully, is that I started out as a psychologist, and I was an educational psychologist and working in schools. And I was a young mum at the same time. And, you know, I got to a point where there was just, and I have to say, I left practicing as a psychologist many, many years ago, before much of the research around positive psychology started coming out. And so I was really frustrated with the ongoing, and the field has changed dramatically over the last 15 years. But at that point in time, there was such a significant focus on dysfunction and let's just look at symptom reduction. And I kept thinking, there's got to be more. There's got to be, even, you know, for many of my young people who will be actually dealing with a mental illness for their whole lives, I still have this innate sense that they have a capacity to thrive. And yet there was not a great deal of work around that. It was very much just about functionality. How do we enable people to function?
Get people back to zero.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is really important. It's very, you know, we can't be talking about flourishing and thriving when I'm actually not able to function in my day-to-day life. And so really important for us to do the foundational work. But because I was in that environment all the time, and then going home to my own children at night, you know, in spite of really great training around drawing boundaries and being able to separate it, I found myself utterly burnt out. And I think particularly because it was dealing with young people day in, day out, that it was really hitting close to home for me. And so I made the call to stop. And it was real, and I can still remember my colleagues saying, are you insane? You've like spent 10 years of your life, you know, invested in studying this, let alone all the practice that you've done. But there was just something in me that was saying, I can't keep going anymore in this. And so I began working in organizations and started looking with organizations around how we could create the conditions for both the individuals in that workplace as well as the business to thrive. And so it was much more focused on that other end of the spectrum. And then probably about 4 years ago, I had this epiphany that here am I teaching all of these, you know, working with these organizations about how they could unlock this potential in their, you know, their staff, and teaching some of these great strategies. And all of a sudden thought, why are we waiting until they're adults? hang on, there's something innately wrong in this. Why aren't we bringing some of this great stuff that we know about into education and building up this capacity at an earlier stage? And so I guess I came full circle that, you know, I started the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology at the University of Melbourne, and my whole capstone research was in how we could marry that together. So how we could create the best of what we know about organizational science and how well that works with what we know about education, and being able to meld those together. And so it was very much about being able to take a systems approach that led me to this. So that's the career reason why. The other reason why is actually totally personal. You know, I hope is actually my number one strength.
Okay.
And I never had language around that until I started uncovering the science of positive psychology, or well-being science. And as soon as I learned about hope theory, I thought, ha, that now makes sense to me, that you know, it's not that I just have that glass half full, but rather right throughout my life, I've been able to find different pathways to, you know, get to that goal that's really, really important to me. And when I realized that that was one of my core strengths, and I was raising two daughters that were going, you know, my two eldest daughters at the time were just finishing BCE and moving into university. And, you know, one of them had an absolute, totally clear sense of what she wanted to do and where she was headed. And the other was so strong in so many different areas that she didn't really know where to best map that to. There wasn't a clear sense of direction. And it really hit me that that's a gap in our schools, that we haven't yet developed, I think, enough of the strategies and processes to help our young people navigate that. And so it was about being able to combine my strengths with some of the gaps that I was seeing, both in Australia, but also on the international stage as well.
And fulfilling your own sense of purpose from the sounds of things.
My work is such a joy, Alan. Like, I have to say, even when I am, you know, totally exhausted, when I'm in with schools, you know, doing that consultation, working with teachers, working with young people to create that opportunity for them to have that aha moment, I just come home so energized. It's just such a great sense of joy.
It's a funny feeling, isn't it? Being both energized and exhausted at the same time. I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I often say, and again, that's part of, I think, what we need to be teaching our young people, that, you know, great success comes with that. It doesn't come with, oh, good, I found my purpose. Now everything is fine and dandy. It comes with hard work that's tiring.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really interesting when you were saying about helping kids. And I'm thinking now about, I mean, I'm thinking from my own personal experience of really that feeling of complete confusion and uncertainty when it came to career choice and the fact that, and I get the sense it's actually a little worse now, perhaps even than it was when I did it. You know, we're expected to choose our subject and then decide on a university course to take, say. Yeah. And that was about it. I'm getting the sense now from talking to young people. I've been on a local panel here in Ballarat helping with a careers night for kids around psychology. So lots and lots, always long queues of kids coming to talk about psychology. Yes. And they're telling me that, oh, well, you know, what subjects do I need to choose in year 10 in order to become a psychologist? So I'm like, well, God, I don't, you know, my career was a bit like yours. You know, I did a commerce degree, I did a psych major, but I wandered off into other areas and didn't come back to psychology until a little later. So there's this pressure to make these decisions early on. And that feeling, because for me, I had a bit like you're describing with your second daughter, you know, I was academically pretty capable, but I didn't have any particularly clear interests that I knew of. I'd never had anyone really talk to me. I mean, I was fortunate because my family did talk about strengths and abilities and what we enjoyed. The things that I had were a little unclear. You know, my top strengths are things like love of learning and judgment, and, you know, which is not for anyone listening, judgment in a kind of negative sense. It's actually more to do with, you know, how we take information in around the world. But it was, yeah, it was a yucky feeling, really. Absolutely. To not know, to feel like I had to make a decision and to really have very little to draw on when it came to making that decision. I have a lot of empathy for kids who are in that situation. And I'm always trying to share, a bit like you were saying, my story and say, look, I didn't really know. I think I was 40 before I really started to get a sense
of all the time
of what I wanted to do.
And that's okay.
Exactly.
However, I think that, you know, telling a 16-year-old, it's okay, when you're 40, you'll be able to work it out, doesn't really resonate.
No, that's a bit overwhelming, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I have to tell you, one of the most powerful bits of feedback that I had from one of our participants on the Hope Labs program actually came from a mum. And she said to me at the end of this session, she goes, I'm blown away. She said, my daughter came into this whole process so overwhelmed by no sense of what she wanted to do and a real sense of anxiety about that. And she said, within 2 weeks of being part of this, she was able to put that to the side and trust the process, like trust that this would actually be a bit of a discovery journey that she would be on. She said, now that it's finished, she says, you know, this kid has got an absolute sense of what her purpose is, and therefore she can suspend that judgment that will actually work out. And so for her, it's not the anchor that, oh, someday it'll all be okay because Rachel said she worked it out when she was 40.
I just have to wait.
Exactly. But rather, she's got that sense of, this is a core coherent part of who I am. And the rest of the stuff I can work and map to that. But if I know who I am, that's my rudder.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and I can relate to that because it's something that I did discover perhaps in my, well, perhaps it was always there to some extent, but you know, it's grown and developed over time. But to be able to have that as a 16-year-old or 18-year-old, you know, that's an amazing gift to be able to give people. So I'm so excited that you're doing this work, that programs like the Hope Labs exist and will hopefully thrive and flourish.
Thank you, Ellen.
Rachel, for people who'd like to find out more, where would you send them?
That's a great question. So probably the simplest way to connect with me, please do feel free to get in contact, and you can do that through my website is one option. I think, Ellen, you were going to pop up details in the show notes.
I will, yep.
But it's merikai.com.au. The spelling's a bit unique, so it's M-E-R-A-K-A-I, for those who are listening, .com.au. So that's one option to be able to get in contact. In terms of where I often publish, it's a lot more on Twitter. So I've been privileged enough to be speaking, you know, all around Australia and on the world stage, and being able to draw on some of those insights. So it's a great way of being able to connect is on Twitter, but also LinkedIn is another really great platform for me to connect with people as well.
Okay, fabulous. And I will put all of those in the show notes so that people can contact you directly if they want to. You've mentioned a number of different scholars in the area, and I will pop the details for those in the show notes as well. Absolutely. Are there any other kind of, are there books or websites or any other sources of information that are perhaps less academic? I know I'm always trying to refer people to things that, you know, goodness, even with years of experience, I find academic papers pretty difficult to slog my way through. Something a little more accessible, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things, and this will be really appropriate for teachers, but also for parents as well, I am part of a team that works on the Positive Psychology Program, which is a whole range of resources for teachers, coaches, parents, etc., which effectively translates the academic science into tools and strategies. So there's a number of resources that are available, and they are just on their website for free of charge. But you can also purchase a subscription to get access to a whole range of different tools to support in that area as well. I have to say one of my favourite websites has actually recently been taken down, which is a real disappointment. So Dr. Shane Lopez's Hope Monger site was a fantastic resource, very, very accessible. However, I would highly recommend his book, and it's called Hope Matters, which is a really tangible, easy, digestible way of understanding the power that hope has and really explicit strategies that we can apply it. So it kind of takes the science and translates it in a really meaningful way for us lay audience.
Perfect. Yes. And I think, yes, we all consider ourselves to be a layperson when it comes to these sorts of things. It's so much easier if it's written for a non-academic audience. We can all conquer those things. So I will pop a link to Hope Matters by Shane Lopez in the show notes. The Positive Psychology Program, I actually am one of their subscribers to that. I use the resources there all the time. So I'll certainly put that. In fact, I think I might already have a link on my website to that, but I'll direct people from your episode page. And look, there are so many other things I feel like I could talk to you about, Rachel. We could go on and on, but in the interest of everybody's time, yours included, we'll finish up here and hopefully have you on again sometime to discuss some of the more of the ins and outs of, you know, hope and purpose and kids and students. I didn't even get a chance to ask you about your work with students at the university level, and there's a lot more to cover off, so perhaps another day.
Absolutely, Ellen. And I suppose in you saying that, it's probably reminded me of another potential longer term resource for some readers to consider. And maybe it can be another day that we chat about that body of work. But the University of Melbourne, in addition to their, you know, more in-depth programs that go into this information, for those that are looking for shorter bursts, they have a couple of really great professional certificates that we run out of the Centre for Positive Psychology. And that really gives people an insight into how this can be particularly applied in an education setting as well as in an organisation setting. So if there's any teachers or those in an organisational setting listening in today, it would be worth perhaps having a look at those to see whether they might be of short interest to you.
Perfect. And I will pop the details on there because I know the Centre for PosPsych well, and I'll find the links to their programs and add those in as well.
Great. Fantastic.
Rachel, thank you so much for your time and your knowledge and your expertise and your ability to translate that into some practical strategies and tools that we can all use, whether we're teachers or parents or anybody who's involved, particularly with young people. So again, thanks for your time, and we'll talk again soon.
Fantastic, Ellen. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
I seriously could have chatted to Rachel all day, and I hope that you now have some ideas and strategies for helping the young people in your life to find their purpose and a sense of hope for the future. You'll find the links to Rachel's consulting firm, Merakai, as well as further information on some of the research and resources that she's mentioned on the Potential Psychology website. Go to potential.com.au/podcast. And if you loved today's episode, please let us know. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes, as that's the best way to spread the word about all of our guests and the work that we do in promoting wellbeing. You can also chat to me via email at ellenjackson@potential.com.au, but I'm also on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Instagram, and you can leave a comment in the comment section on our podcast episode page. So wherever you'd like to hang out, let's start the conversation. You can even leave me a voice message via the Potential Psychology website. Go to the podcast episodes and show notes page. Click the orange button on the left-hand side that says start recording, and let's chat. Now, next week, we will be continuing the theme of young people and their well-being when I talk to Dr. Michael Carr-Gregg, who is one of Australia's highest profile psychologists. He's the author of at least 11 books. He's a broadcaster and a specialist in parenting, children, adolescents, and the use of technology for mental health. And Michael and I are going to ask the question, are we getting it right when it comes to the mental health of our kids? Because I believe he has some pretty strong views on the topic. So join me next week for that interview. I'm really looking forward to it. And until then, have a great week, and I'll see you soon.